Hello, everyone, and welcome to another dual podcast with Dodge City Public Library and Comic Pop Library. We are at the 2013 Wine and Cheese program here at the Dodge City Public Library. This program is held an annual is being held as an annual fundraiser for the Dodge City Public Library Friends Foundation. Tonight's sponsors for the event are Fidelity State Bank and Trust, High Plains Journal, Cargill Meat Solutions, Comanche Beverage Outlet.
I'm sitting here under a shady tree.
We listen to the wind blow.
You might think just from looking at me
that I move a little slow.
But don't believe everything that you see,
'cause you never really know.
I'm just waiting for you to catch up with me,
and I got nowhere to go.
Tonight, we are honored to have Michael J. Everett, or Mike, the adjunct curator of the I can't talk tonight.
You haven't even started drinking yet. That's the sad part.
You haven't started reading the long words either.
That's coming here pretty soon. But Mike is the adjunct curator of the Vertebrate Paleontology of Sternum Museum of Natural History in Hays, Kansas. Hope I got everything right there, Mike.
Close.
I apologize. He has several credits to his name. When you look him up, you can see he has several articles, participated in several projects, books, films. But tonight we are focusing on the book entitled Oceans of Kansas. So, Michael, thank you for coming here tonight for us.
Well, good evening. I'm glad to be here.
When most people look at Kansas, they don't really think of an ocean. If you would talk to people from outside of Kansas especially, or here right now during the drought. Can you describe where the ocean was, the breadth, you know, because I know it wasn't just Kansas.
Certainly, and yeah, I have the same problem imagining this whole part of the United States, not just Kansas, covered with an ocean. Back in the late Cretaceous, when we had our last ocean, the Western Interior Seaway here, it stretched from the Gulf of Mexico clear to the Arctic, and from Utah, Arizona, all the way into Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota even, and up into Canada, of course. So it was roughly as large as the Mediterranean Sea, but oriented north-south in place of east-west.
So was this collapsed into the Mississippi River eventually? Or
no, it's not a collapse. What is happening is that the plate tectonics, the west of the Pacific plate, is actually sliding under the North America plate, and that's why we have the Sierra Madres and the Rocky Mountains and all of that being pushed up. And that started, 300 million years ago or so, but it's continuing today. That's why we have a hot spot under Yellowstone. But the impact or the sliding under the North American plate is what's folded the west edge of North America into mountains and volcanoes and eventually lifted the Great Plains above sea level.
And the book itself, is it sitting around the Cretaceous period, or pretty much which period would it fall?
Well, it would be the late Cretaceous. Yeah, that's I'm concentrating on the last ocean that covered Kansas. Kansas has actually been underwater for more than half a billion years. All of the rocks that we have in this state, all of our mineral resources are from sea bottom. Oil, gas, salt, gypsum, limestone, chalk, all of these things are formed at the bottom of oceans that have covered Kansas for hundreds of millions of years.
Okay. And one of the interesting things when I was looking through this, you said you made a point to saying there was no dinosaurs. And there was a different classification. And for the listeners, could you explain the classification and why there's no dinosaurs per se?
Okay. A couple of things are important here. We don't have any dinosaurs, or very few dinosaurs were living in Kansas. There is one specimen that is at the KU Museum that lived on the edge of the Seaway and is died and buried in the what we call the Dakota Sandstone. But for the most part, it was an ocean, and dinosaurs don't live in oceans. They live on land. They walk. They don't swim. So all of our marine creatures, our sea monsters, if you will, were adapted to living and swimming in the ocean. And they had paddles in place of feet, and they lived their entire lives in the water. They were analogous, if you will, to dolphins and whales today, but they were all reptiles.
Okay. And we all know about the bigger creatures, the bigger fish. What are some of the more unique, smaller things that you found out about this era that most people kind of dismiss, but is still unique and interesting for you?
Oh, I could go on and on there. Of course, yeah, we have some very large fish and sharks evident in the rocks, primarily the Smoky Hill Chalk where I work. But with every ocean, there are billions and billions of smaller things for all of the predators that we tend to collect and highlight in museums. There's, you know, literally millions of smaller fish that died so that predators could grow to that size. So we've got a big coelacanth here. We've got lots of little sharks, carpet sharks, little shark called Scapanorhynchus that has tiny teeth, you know, less than an inch in size. Certainly something that would be analogous to the little shore-dwelling sharks that we see today that, you know, never bite people. But beyond that, we...
Not even a nibble?
Not even a nibble. Unless you step on them, and then okay. You might be in trouble. But we also have the first birds with teeth here in Kansas. Okay. The first ones that were found, literally, were found in the Smoky Hill Chalk in the 1870s, about 1871. And some of those birds were no bigger than a pigeon, but they apparently were flying out to sea. They apparently were like seagulls to some extent, and we find the remains here. We certainly have most of the world's specimens of pteranodon. I'll talk about it a little bit more tonight, but pteranodon is the world's most familiar pterosaur.
Okay.
It's been in movies all the way from King Kong and The Lost World, all the way up through Jurassic Park. Everybody in the world knows about pteranodon, but it only occurs here. So it's got a good press agent over the years. We've got a swimming bird called Hesperornis that also has teeth. It would be very similar to, say, penguins today, cold water bird coming down from Canada area. And a whole variety of fish. The ocean, if you were swimming in it, besides the big sea monsters that we'll talk about, the mosasaurs and plesiosaurs, probably wouldn't look that different from the fish that you would see in the Caribbean today. Of course, they were different species, but there were very much the same kinds of fish, and it would have been fairly normal ocean in that respect.
Okay. And it was kind of interesting, the first documented academia-wise fossil was with Lewis and Clark?
Yes, the first fossil found in the Western Interior Seaway was actually collected by the Lewis and Clark cross-country expedition in 1804 and 1805. And it wasn't found in Kansas, but it was found in what we would consider the Niobrara Chalk, the same deposit that covers Western Kansas. But it was found along the Missouri River, and I think up in Iowa. And it was just the jaw of a fish called Sauradon, a little fish that is odd because, unlike a swordfish, it has its sword on the lower jaw. And
That's different.
For whatever reason, that was the only fossil. They collected many fossils, but that was the only one that made it back to the East Coast, and it's now in the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia.
With the archaeology, with the digs, how many have you been on over the years? Several,
I'm sure. I've never been on an archaeology dig.
You've done your own digging?
No, these are paleontology digs. There's a very big difference.
Apologize. Okay.
I don't know, two or three a year for the last 20 years. Most of the time, they're not very big digs. You know, we're not digging up dinosaurs here that are 100 feet long. The biggest creature that I've worked on was probably 30 feet long, mosasaur.
It's pretty impressive still.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You wouldn't go on a swimming with him because He'd have ruined your day. But we collect during good weather, most all around year round, and lots of times a dig is a day long. In the terms of that mosasaur, we came back on weekends for 3 months during the summer because it was so big and because we had to move so much rock to get to it. But what I like about working in the chalk is that most of the discoveries are fairly small and manageable. Okay. Dinosaurs are not.
On the digs, it's not the smash and grab and go like we see in the movies, though. It's pretty painstakingly mapped out, isn't it? And trying to keep stuff in the quadrants.
It's not like an archaeology dig. We're not sifting through the soil an inch or half an inch at a time.
Okay.
Usually when we find a fossil, it's a piece of bone or bones that are already coming out of the rock. And the first thing that we do is scout around it, make sure we pick up all the loose pieces, and then we start digging back into the rock and uncovering the thing as we go and figuring out how big it is. And once we've got it located, then we can actually start doing things to take it out of the ground. Photography has been a big blessing, if you will, for note-taking. We do most of our notes, I suppose, or a lot of the things that we do is just by taking photographs as we go through the dig and carefully locating things like that. We still do use paper notes,
right?
But photography, digital photography, has saved us a lot of time and effort.
And with the digs themselves, the hikers in Kansas and campers still find the shark teeth kind of loose. And with private individuals, do they, like yourself, still stumble across stuff that's interesting for the academia, or is it pretty much centered around the professional?
Certainly. The more eyes, the better. Actually, more fossils are found by amateurs or private individuals, if you will, than are found by paleontologists. We simply don't have enough time to be everywhere and see everything that the rest of the public is doing. We just had a dedication at the Sternberg Museum last Wednesday on Fossil Day, National Fossil Day, for a turtle specimen that had been collected from a ranch south of Quinter, Kansas, and donated by the family to the Sternberg Museum. And it was found by a group of amateurs that notified me that they had something coming out of the ground. We went out and determined that it was there, and then got all our resources together to get it out.
And you mentioned in the Oceans of Kansas, one of the theorems, I believe, if I get the name right, J.D. Stewart.
J.D. Stewart.
His theory was collect everything and then see what you have later. You want to expound on that and some of the things that have come about?
J.D.'s idea was that if you don't know what it is, pick it up and take it home or take it back to the lab with you. If you throw it down, you'll never find it again. So we kind of turned it into what we call it hoovering. We were literally picking up every scrap of bone and teeth that we found and then, you know, and putting it, bagging it, taking notes on it and everything. And then, if necessary, figuring out what it was. You can always throw it away, but if you don't pick it up, you've lost it.
And we want to mention you do have a website. Would
certainly.
Would you like to give that website for us? And we can put it in the show notes as well.
Just Google Oceans of Kansas, and it's all over.
Okay. Yeah. And I believe there's a link there where you can purchase the book online.
Don't want to plug somebody, but there's a major online bookshop, if you will. Starts with an A.
That's fine. You can do that. We're a nonprofit.
It's literally the best place to buy it. I'm not much of a book salesman, and I let them do it. Or it can be ordered direct from Indiana Press in Bloomington. But the best way of getting it is to go to Amazon.com.
And within the book, there's several plays by Dave Veert. I got to pronounce his name right, or he might call me
Dave.
And let me know. I do have his name here somewhere. Honestly, have you worked with him? Dan Varner.
My artist. yeah.
And have you worked with him for several years? I mean, he's very exceptional artist. I mean, he captures the underwater scenes nicely.
He is was an exceptional artist. Okay. I've worked with him since the mid 1990s. Unfortunately, he died last year, and we've lost a great artist because he was has done a better job with underwater lighting, if you will, and bringing these animals back to life as much as we can based on the scientific knowledge. And that was his forte, as far as I'm concerned, is that he did not exaggerate. He used things that were scientifically valid, and he made them real.
Okay. And like I said, an exceptional prints. I mean, a lot of people, if they're interested in this, would even like to have these framed, probably. Or posters, just a regular poster for the children. I mean, they'd probably love these. You mentioned in your book, then it was put out a few years ago, several species are still being found. Is that still true at this time?
Oh, certainly.
About how many species do you think are found a year, roughly?
Well, we've been naming them over the last 15 years at a rate of one or two a year. I mean, it's not a matter of, one, first you have to find a specimen, or several specimens, hopefully, and then you have to describe it. You have to show why it is different. And that's become a more, I guess, scientific process over the years. When Cope and Marsh were out here in the 1870s, if they picked up a bone and they didn't recognize it, they usually named it some other animal. And we've been struggling over the last 140 years trying to straighten out all of the things that they did wrong. I mean, they were...
Reclassify them in their proper place.
Right. Put them in the right place. Because they split everything up into too many species that really aren't here. So we've collected better specimens. We've got a better idea what the differences are between species. We've actually named two new species of mosasaurs from Kansas right after the book was produced, or was written, 2005 and 2007. We've got two new species of fish. We've recognized several new species of sharks here. So, you know, we're just progressing along with continuing to look for material and, you know, hopefully find things that are different. Any time that you're collecting fossils, you're only getting a knothole view of what was actually there, because these are the things that were lucky enough to be preserved and not eaten or destroyed prior to preservation. And then they're twice as lucky for being discovered and collected. And then it just takes somebody to take it from that point and recognize what it is and name it, if you will.
And with your career, you've been blessed and fortunate to work on, like I said before, many projects. But two of the neater ones that I kind of thought that is unexpected was you worked with the BBC and the National Geographic on a couple of documentaries or docudramas. I don't know how you would call the National Geographic one. I've seen it, but I haven't seen the BBC one. But tell us about the experience with that. Was that kind of unique and more interesting, or kind of more of a letdown for you on how they produce a movie?
It was an educational experience.
Political answer there.
I've learned a lot from the movie business, I guess, and I've learned that I don't want to be in the movie business, I suppose. Working with directors and producers and camera people and sound guys and whatever out in the field, you know, I'm always in the business of educating them about what I'm seeing, and hopefully priming them to ask the right questions when I'm on camera. But, you know, they've got their own vision of what they want the scene to look like, or how they want to see me in the scene. And, you know, we do it over and over again, and you spend hours getting 15 seconds for a clip sometimes.
So what's more painstaking, the movie making or the documenting of fossils?
Well, we'd like to think that documenting about the fossils is a lot more scientific.
That's your love, and you enjoy it probably too.
But, you know, the movies are great too, because it gives us a chance to portray these creatures to the public in a way that to me at least, is more understandable and less sensational. I mean, these were beautiful, wonderful animals. They don't have to, you know, be giganticized, if you will, or, you know, be shown tearing things apart to make them pretty incredible. They're incredible just by their size, their diversity, the fact that they were here, and they ruled the world, literally, during the late Cretaceous. So,
and animation has gotten so far advanced that it really makes it look a lot nicer now.
If you look at the BBC movie Walking with Dinosaurs, the first one that came out, you see it's pretty crude. They hadn't figured out, you know, when they showed the little things like the mammals, how to put hair on a mammal in an animated film. In Sea Monsters, it was 10 times or 100 times better. The artists, the guys that are doing the CG work, are getting so good at it now, it's becoming very difficult to tell what's real and what's animation. That was 5-6 years ago, and the technology, the size of computers, all of that stuff has jumped by leaps and bounds, and I would love to do it again. It would be so much better.
Well, I think I know that just with our library alone, the checkouts are tremendous on them. And I know that, I think, did it not Hutch have the sea creatures at their
Sea dome? Monsters. Sea Monsters, I thought. Sea Monsters is actually released all over the world. It's been in Moscow. I was hoping to get an invite to go open it over there. I did open it in a 24-hour period in Portland, Oregon, and in Galveston, Texas. That's the first time I've had a red-eye flight from Portland to Galveston. But we opened it all over the world. It was first shown to a group of teachers in Australia because of the international dateline and everything. They saw it first. But by then, of course, in helping put it together, I'd already seen all of the scenes over and over again. But it was still nice to see it on that 60-foot screen.
And seeing the reaction.
And watch the audience reaction to it. The 3D version of it is spectacular.
And before we leave out, we're getting close to the time where the program's going to be starting. But I want to mention one of the Sternberg's more probably recognizable displays, and if you could mention how rare it is and unique, and that's the Fish and the Fish. That's not common, is it? That's kind
Well, Zafactinus as a fish, I don't want to ever dig up another one. There are that many of them out there. Okay. But the fish within a fish specimen that we have on exhibit at the Sternberg is unique. There's nothing else that ever has been found that will compare to it. We found bigger ones, of course, but nothing that is as complete and as well-preserved and as, you know, knock-your-eyes-out sort of showmanship that it has. So, you know, I could tell you and show you about every major museum has got a Zafactinus, but this is the only one that's got a complete fish inside.
Okay. And do you do some tours at the museum when people come in, or what's your function at the museum up there? And
I'm a paleontologist.
Right, but when the kids come in, do you come out?
I have given tours at the museum. I generally work with students that are coming in to look at our collections. I'm more the behind the scenes guy. Okay. We have an education director and staff and the docents and everything that conduct the school kids sort of things routinely during the week, but I'm there working with fossils, working with students from. We've had people from Canada. We had a girl, teacher actually, working on her master's degree from Japan last year, and you know, she'd come all the way across the country or across around the world to come to the museum because we had some very unique specimens there. And so those are the things that I generally do for the museum, in addition to guided tours and collections. And the thing last week for National Fossil Day, we talked to 370 kids and a bunch of adults had the dedication of the Protostego turtle and lots of other things. So.
And they might see you walking around, though, if nothing else. Even though you might not be behind
the
scenes. But
the other part of my title says adjunct.
So you're outside a lot.
I'm I'm not there a lot, but anyway, I am a basically retired. Adjunct means there's no salary, no retirement, and no tenure.
But you have fun.
But I have fun. But it's got me in museums all over the world. Just the fact that I am on staff there has been invaluable. And it kind of raises your credibility to a level where I'm working with professional paleontologists all over the world. I write books. I've published more than 40 professional papers. This is kind of my third career after doing a lot of other things to earn a living. So,
well, it's definitely, this is one of those things where you're a child. This is what you think about, is the dinosaurs and the dinosaur period and what's in the oceans. And that's kind of more of the unique, because a lot of it's been centered around the land dinosaurs. And we're now with the sea monsters. That's kind of gotten the kids into seeing what's in the oceans.
Well, I hope so. And one of the things I'll show in the presentation tonight is that during this period of time, during the late Cretaceous, sea levels were at an all-time high. All the low-lying areas around the world were flooded. The Earth was a water planet. Only 15% of the Earth's surface was land, and that's where all the dinosaurs got crowded up into. But the oceans were ruled by these huge marine creatures, and they covered the planet from pole to pole. And, you know, they don't get enough good press as far as that goes. Right. But I started out being interested in dinosaurs, and, hey, some of us don't grow up.
We know that here, especially the Comic Pop Library podcast. We like to have a young mind and young heart. So that's an important thing in life, young mind and young heart, and having fun.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Mike, for coming in with us tonight. We hope you enjoy your visit here with us, and we get some nice, good taste of wine that you can relax and
hey, I'm in the spotlight. Spotlight, I don't get to relax. Never mind.
Afterwards, you can relax.
There you go.
But thank you for joining us tonight. And before we leave out, I would like to make a brief mention that last year we interviewed Jim Shearer. He was one of the past officers of the foundation for the Wine and Cheese event. He passed away this last year, so we'd like to make mention that we appreciated visiting with him. He was a fun guest as well. Want to wish their families heartfelt condolences. So thank you for listening, and we're having fun. I hope everybody's having fun out there too. Have a good one, everybody.
If you want to find a place that's worry-free, well, then you know just where to go. Whoa. Just sit right down here next to me, where the tall grass grow. Whoa. We'll take our cue from the birds and the bees. They seem to really know. A song on my ukulele, and this is how it goes. I think I'm doing pretty fine. I'm finally feeling okay. There's nothing left of me inside. I put all my worries away. I'm happy with just wasting time, just sitting around all day. I'm drinking all your honey wine. I think I'll have a little more. Whoa.
Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.